From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite. Today on the show, we'll gain some insight into the thousands of driver's licenses suspended each year in Milwaukee. Later, the story of four new books by gardening contributor Melinda Myers. We'll catch up with a woman trying to spice up local food with African flavor.
Learning the culture of, I say, the cuisines of Africa in a way that's non-threatening, that is accessible, that is relatable to the food that people can identify with.
And an exhibition at the Milwaukee Art Museum features a 19th century painter with a 21st century approach.
He has his finger on the pulse of pop culture. If Sully were painting today, I guarantee you he would have attempted a tasteful version of Fifty Shades of Grey. Sully would have painted a scene from it and made it as dramatic and beautiful as he knew how. Yeah.
Lake Effect is next after this news update. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tike. Thank you so much for being with us today. One of the issues that's been raised in our Project Milwaukee series, Black Men in Prison, is that the offenses that often get men in Milwaukee County on the road to incarceration are seemingly innocuous crimes, such as driving on a suspended driver's license. It turns out that as Milwaukee County leads Wisconsin in the incarceration of black men, the county is also well ahead of the rest of the state in suspending driving privileges, a phenomenon known as an FPF suspension. That story was reported this week by the online Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and reporter Rick Brown joins us in the studio to explain. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with a very basic question here. What is the significance of what's known as an FPF suspension? What does that stand for, and why do people get them?
FPF suspensions refer to failure to pay forfeiture suspensions. And what these mean are driver's license suspensions that stem from unpaid traffic tickets. So if you get a traffic ticket, let's say it's for speeding, it could be something for something as small as a seatbelt violation, then you typically will have 2 to 3 months to pay that. If you don't, then the court can order your license suspended through the Wisconsin DOT. And this suspension then lasts 2 years or until it's paid.
Well, and there are some in this story who say it can even start with something as simple as a parking ticket. How does that get wrapped into it? Because a parking ticket isn't necessarily a driving violation.
It typically starts with a parking ticket for many lower income individuals. For example, if you get a parking ticket, then what can happen is that your registration can be suspended. Once that's suspended, you can then be stopped and then ticketed. Once you're ticketed for that, then the failure to pay forfeiture suspension comes into play if you can't pay that ticket. So something as small as a parking ticket can set you down the road to a suspension later on.
Why is this a significant issue now? Well, what do the numbers say about it?
The numbers are rising, and they're rising both in the county and statewide. In fact, in 2011, 97,000 FPF suspensions were given to Milwaukee County residents. And on a statewide level, these have actually increased from 44% from 2008 to 2011.
Do we know why the numbers are rising? Is it greater enforcement?
That's a good question. I've spoken to a number of people, and what I get a greatest sense of is that there are two main factors leading this. The first has to do with the introduction of mandatory insurance laws. And of course, in June 2010, Wisconsin became one of the last states to introduce this. And that introduced yet another ticket to a kind of mixture of tickets that low-income drivers typically can't afford to pay. In addition to that, there is the general recession and the loss of disposable income in many people.
What are the demographics of this issue? Obviously, anybody can be arrested for, say, OWI or speeding, but does this disproportionately affect any particular demographic group?
It does. In fact, if you look at a UWM study of this from 2008 to 2011, you can see that the north side and the south side are the most hit areas of Milwaukee. And in fact, 82% of the people who received suspensions during that time frame were minorities, and 65% were African American.
Well, and so what's the upshot of this? Are people staying off the roads or driving even as their license is suspended?
Typically, and this is the case in most of the people who I've spoken to, typically people will drive anyway because they feel that it's a necessity for employment.
Well, and so do people end up going to jail over this?
They can. This has a large sort of constellation of effects. And this can affect, for example, it can affect health. If you can't drive, for example, you can't get to appointments, you can't take your children to appointments. It can also affect down the line things such as if you lose your employment, it can increase these numbers.
Well, and employment is a key part of this picture, I assume, because that's one key reason why people drive.
It is. Employment is a huge issue. A driver's license is – it's not just a key to employment, but it's also something that affects your ability to be desirable to employers. Many times it's used as kind of an applicant filter or a measure of responsibility. And in addition to that, there's the issue that many jobs are moving out of Milwaukee's, you know, central city. And to reach those, you have to drive.
You did talk to some people who defended these suspensions as an appropriate punishment for a violation. What was their argument?
Well, I spoke to Sheldon Himley, who's the chief court administrator for Milwaukee Municipal Court, and their argument effectively was that if you can afford to pay gas, if you can afford to pay typical vehicle maintenance, then you can afford to pay for fines. However, I've also spoken to other individuals such as Jim Gramling, who was a former municipal judge, and they say that even if you can budget these in, typically once you get a certain level of tickets, you're not going to be able to pay them if you're a low-income or no-income individual.
Do municipalities offer people the chance to pay these fines off in installments?
Yes, you can get on a payment plan, and there are a number of different options here. Once you get on it, actually, you can have that suspension in some cases lifted while you pay it. But for many of the people who I've spoken to, even those installments are typically not something that they can afford.
There are a number of organizations and agencies that actually work on behalf of people who have these FPF suspensions. How are those groups trying to break the cycle?
Yes. Probably the most prominent group in Milwaukee is the Center for Driver's License Recovery and Employability. They are offering case management services and legal assistance to clients who typically are at or under 200% of the federal poverty level. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to give people who in many cases simply don't have a way out of this cycle to either pay off their fines through payment plans or to do community service, which in some municipalities is available.
So how do they go about doing it?
What they typically do is if you're – let's say you're a client, and typically their clients are facing FPF suspensions. That's the largest driver's license issue they're confronting. What they'll do is they'll have you come in for a consultation. They'll have you sit down, and if you need legal assistance, then they'll direct you to one of their attorneys. They have two and also a volunteer attorney as well. And they will lead you through your driver's record. They'll show you what the issues are and how to resolve them. And it can be extremely difficult. I spoke to an attorney there, Molly Gina, and she made reference specifically to the fact that if you're driving, let's say, if you had to drive to, you know, another city, you can receive tickets in any jurisdiction along the way. So many people are not able to deal with the fact that they have to deal with maybe three, four, or more court systems. So they walk you through that.
But at the same time, these numbers show that there are 97,000 people in Milwaukee County who have received these FPF suspensions. What kind of impact does this center have?
It is true. The center definitely deals with a relatively small population as opposed to the overall impact. They typically per year will try to enroll 325 people into their services, and they'll try to advise a further 400. So if you're looking at the total numbers, it is a little bit of a drop in the bucket, but they're hoping to address a larger issue through policy changes.
And you spoke with one of the people that heads up the center, and we're going to hear a clip of tape from her now talking about the work that they're trying to accomplish.
All participants must be under 200% of the poverty line. So we are working with low-income or no-income individuals. We really try to look at it on a case-by-case basis to see what would work best for that client. Something that sounds as simple as recovering a license, which is actually much more complicated than it sounds, that person is then able to become a more productive member of their community and, you know, Milwaukee benefits as a whole then.
That was Angela Catania from the Center for Driver's License Recovery and Employability. We're talking with Rick Brown from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. You also talked with some people who are dealing with this issue. In fact, one who was seeking out the services of the center. And can you kind of give us a sense for what their feelings about how this is all playing out are?
Yes. I spoke to Hakeem Fudge. He's 22 and he lives on the north side. He had a probationary license which expired in 2010. And since that time, he's gotten 15 unpaid city tickets, which have resulted in suspensions. The way he described it, it had been extremely difficult because he would receive more tickets on top of other tickets because he still had to drive. He felt it was a necessity. He's an MATC student. But at the same time, in order to pay off these, I mean, he had to go to school. He had to work. It put him in kind of a catch-22 situation in which in order to work and to go to school, he had to have his license. But at the same time, in order to have his license, he had to pay off these fines.
Let's hear just a bit of Hakeem Fudge, who you spoke with.
I can't take myself nowhere. If I, you know, I get pulled over a lot, I get more tickets on top of more tickets. So it's like, it's put me in a hole because obviously I ain't paid them tickets, so I got more tickets and more money to pay that I don't have. So, you know, it's consequences.
Why isn't public transportation part of this conversation?
For many of the people whom I spoke to, public transportation was something of a limited option. There is obviously the fact that many of the new jobs, you know, which are available to Milwaukee's inner city communities are not going to be in the central city. So where the buses don't run, you can't take public transportation. But in addition to that, there's the fact that over the years, the mileage and hours of MCTS has actually decreased. And furthermore, if you have children, if you're not just a single individual going to work and back home, it can be very difficult to use public transportation effectively.
Is this an issue that is on the radar screen of legislators? I gather there is some proposed legislation that might make things a bit better.
Yes, there is. The Center for Driver's License Recovery and Employability is currently proposing a change in the length of these suspensions. It should go, they would argue, from 2 years to 6 months. And they're currently lobbying for this change, which they hope might be able to get traction in next spring. And their argument for this is that the majority of payments that are made after these suspensions take place occur in the first 6 months. So what they're arguing is that the longer suspension period is not only is it ineffective, but it basically simply removes people's ability to get employment in many cases, which does not allow them to pay.
Well, and at the end of the day, it seems as though the various municipalities would want these fines paid.
Yes, very much so. And in fact, what many of the people whom I've spoken to at the center have argued is that by reducing the suspension length, you're actually going to allow people to get employment and to more effectively pay these off. Revenues, therefore, will increase, and it can have a positive impact on these municipalities as a whole.
Rick Brown, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Rick Brown is a reporter for the online Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. You'll find a link to his article and multimedia presentation on the issue of driver's license suspensions in Milwaukee County from WUWM.com/lakeeffect. Keep listening. Some new books for the gardener or would-be gardener in your life from our gardening contributor, Melinda Myers, when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. We talked with our gardening contributor, Melinda Myers, last week about her late fall gardening suggestions. We also mentioned she has a bumper crop of new gardening books just out or just about to come out. But we ran out of time to talk about them. So this morning, Melinda joins us again for just a couple minutes to talk about the titles aimed at gardeners in our neck of the woods. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mitch. Always great to be here.
So it's been a while since there's been a new Melinda Myers book gracing our shelves or getting covered in potting soil out in our gardening shed. But the good news for fans of yours is that there are several, including one that's already out, right?
You bet. So those folks who have bought my garden guides in the past, I've updated it. It's a new title, Getting Started Garden Guide, and we've combined Minnesota and Wisconsin. I'd done both books, so I'm very conscious of the difference between Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and northern Minnesota, and I mentioned that. But I talk about plants. I've added, I think about 50 new plants to the book. Got rid of some of the older plants that I warned you about being too aggressive or invasive, so hopefully I got that message over to you so I can save that space and put something new and different in. Updated cultivars, talked about some combinations and new varieties to try. So I'm very excited. It just came out. Hopefully people who have the original or the second edition will consider this one, or it's a great gift for beginning and experienced gardeners.
And we should note that you also have another version for Michigan as well.
You bet. So anybody listening from across the lake or with relatives, I've been lucky enough to do quite a bit of work over in Michigan. I always say they're on the milder side of the lake. So I have a few extra plants that they can grow that we can't. But, you know, with that last snowfall, they had a little more snow than we did. So I guess it all evens out.
Now, the title that always helps me prepare for these interviews is the Month by Month Gardening in Wisconsin book. You have a new version of that that you've also combined with Minnesota, and that's coming out in December.
You bet. So the Month by Month Minnesota, Wisconsin book is really the same concept, what to do when, but it's reorganized. Finding that gardeners found it would be easier that if you open up January and you see everything you need to do in January with all your garden plants, and then in February. So I talk about lawns, trees, shrubs, ground covers, ornamental grasses, herbs and vegetables. So trying to help you address those things that'll help you prepare for what you need to do now for the season ahead, or pest problems you might encounter, or some ideas of how to be more successful and, of course, have fun in your garden.
And I misspoke. That title is available in January, correct?
Right.
The one coming out in December is the Midwest Gardener's Handbook.
You bet. So taking a broader scope, looking around the Midwest, a lot on plants, some plant profiles. A few we can't grow, but we can only drool. And maybe those, you know, people with zone envy might give them a try. But also combining some month-by-month tips, combination plants that are good throughout most of the Midwest. So 90%, if not 95% of the plants we can grow. I took care of us here in Wisconsin, believe me.
Well, an exciting time, and we'll be looking for those at a bookstore or a library near us.
Thanks.
Thank you. Melinda Myers is our regular gardening contributor and the author of numerous books on gardening, including her latest, which include the Getting Started Garden Guide for Minnesota and Wisconsin, the Getting Started Garden Guide for Michigan, the Midwest Gardener's Handbook, and Month by Month Gardening in Minnesota and Wisconsin. You'll find a link to more about all of them at wuwm.com/lake effect. Another short break now, and then we'll catch up with a force of nature, a woman whose single mission is to infuse Wisconsin cuisine with African flavors. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Almost exactly a year ago, we introduced you to Yolande Deacon, who had recently set out to add a unique stamp to the local foods movement. She and her Wauwatosa-based company, Afro Fusion Cuisine, were working to combine the local foods movement with a cooking tradition from far away, her native Cameroon. A year later, the company has expanded what it makes and expanded its mission a bit, and so we invited Deacon back to the Lake Effect studio for an update. Nice to see you again.
I am super thrilled to be here. This is one of my favorite programs.
Well, we are super thrilled to have you back. And I think the last time we spoke with you was about a year ago, I think, and you had been putting together spices, spice packages and varieties of spices for people to try African cuisine in their homes. How has your business evolved in the time since then?
It has been a fantastic ride. I would say Afrofusion Cuisine has been the pioneer in the field. Just going to farmers market, festivals, and starting in retail location, organic stores like Outpost Natural Food, Good Harvest in Waukesha. And what we did was to introduce firsthand simple organic African blends. So just going back to memories of my childhood, what I tried to do was to recreate using locally available herbs and working with some very good social conscious groups, organic farms like Wellspring, Paoli Food, Alice Garden, to come up with something that I felt was good enough and represent that great food that I grew up eating. So blends like suya is a specific West African barbecue blend that you will not find in other regions. I put together a beriberi blend, a Moroccan tagine, what we call spicy barbecue. And what I try to do is, because it was the introductory product that we were out there to get similar names that are accessible to people. So when I'm talking about suya, for example, I would say spicy barbecue. And as I'm getting conversation with people in store, I can actually tell the story. But the whole adventure, and it has been a great journey, was how to get Milwaukee excited and interested in learning the culture of, I say, the cuisines of Africa in a way that's non-threatening, that is accessible, that is relatable to the food that people can identify with, but the flavor that they always get surprised by. So it's been great. I mean, I can't complain. I'm here 12 months after, and I'm very excited and even more excited than ever.
Afrofusion has evolved to some ready-made sauces as opposed to just spices. Does that reflect maybe a realization of the different ways people might have of cooking here? The reality seems to be that we are increasingly a ready-made sauce kind of culture versus a start-from-scratch culture.
I say you're totally right. One of the things that, you know, happened to us, and it was a great thing, was we signed up for the Wauwatosa Farmers Market, you know, during the summer, and it's the best focus group that we could possibly have. And as we went to the market, we talked to real people, everyday moms and dad, and from all ages. And what we heard over and over is, Yolande, great idea to bring the spices, but African cuisine is still so foreign to us that we need an easy entry point, which would be give us the convenience, the access, and something that's easy to get into. And as I was serving various dishes at the farmer's market involving sauces, there's a fantastic lady, Jill, who stopped by and said, Yolande, I think you should market this sauce. And I said, really? And she said, yeah, this sauce is so good. And this would be the perfect way to introduce the community to cooking. Because think about it. All we have to do is let the sauce simmer, chop vegetables and add to it, and let it cook for 5-10 minutes. Or let the sauce simmer, add meat to it. So depending on your diet, the simmer sauce is a great concept. And it's even better when it's done with fresh, natural ingredients. So what I decided to do was to team up with some of the farmers that were already at farmers market and come up with an idea of, this is a sauce that you feel you're making from your own kitchen when you have time, or your mom made it for you, or your neighbor that you know, and you know where it's harvested because it's planted and harvested in your community, and it's still done in small batches. I still make the sauces in my little, very small batches that, you know, yield as much as 20 to 25 liters.
Did this take some shift in your mind? This might seem a little like cheating, or certainly not the way that you grew up cooking. You know, you didn't necessarily use ready-made sauces.
Yes. And actually, when I think about it, I do the cooking so that you can enjoy a quicker meal. So the whole concept of slow cooking is still there, but I'm shifting the burden of the cooking to me as opposed to be to the consumer. So I still do the simmering. I still do the chopping and the selecting of vegetable. I mean, I have some picture of myself and Vinicius William harvesting fresh vegetables out of Alice Garden. Some of the discussion that I had with Wellspring Organic Farm. So that selection garden process. That's part of my upbringing, where we had our garden, you know, just by the house, farms all over. So it's still happening. I enjoy that process so much. And what I really, really love is the love and the passion that those urban farmers put in growing the vegetables that we have all around Milwaukee. It takes me back home. And I think it's that total solution, that total package that the consumer may not have access to, that I'm actually packaging in a jar with a lot of love and passion.
Well, and do you think that perhaps people, after they have cooked for a while with these sauces, might think, well, maybe the next step for me is to try making these sauces for myself?
I've seen that happening already. As I started sampling the sauces at, you know, Good Harvest and Outpost Natural Stores, what I've seen, actually, it's interest now in both product. Because, again, as I look at the Afrofusion line, I look at the spices are for people who enjoy cooking from scratch, experimenting with different flavors, and who have the time to do so and the knowledge. And it's not a gift that everybody has. And I respect that. And that's why I thought about the sauces for the moms and the dads who are very busy during the week, but who still want to have the convenience and the comfort that they're feeding their family with something that's healthy and something that's good, but easy to make. You have a 30-minute meal. Just open one of those great jars, and it's real food. So it's perishable. It's refrigerated in the stores so that we keep that integrity of African cooking. I don't have any artificial preservative. Actually, most of what I use is lemon juice. So for those, it appeals to those who are interested in eating, again, farm fresh produce from their neighborhood, from the like of Alice Garden, you know, Wellspring, Paoli Farm, and a lot of farms that I'm discovering every day. Because as I'm talking to you today, I mean, it's a message also about good food. All the work that's being done around town to create green land within the city. As I'm doing Afrofusion sauces, I'm thinking about a socially conscious product that not only feed you and nourish the person who is actually getting it with something great, but also supporting the community in which we live. And I think it's really, I feel it's great.
What's the hardest part of this job for you?
The hardest part, it's going out there and not knowing how well it's going to be received. I'm going to be very candid with you. I've been telling people I'm taking a lot of risk. The risk is African food is still very foreign to a lot of people. Not only I'm doing African food, meaning really ethnic, I'm going very authentic with the recipes. So a lot of flavors that may shock some palates. So you got to be ready for it. I call it an explosion of flavor. And so it's ethnic, but I'm going with local farms, so consistency in product availability is a challenge. And there's a ton of education that needs to be done. So not only I'm pioneering a category in the whole Midwest, I mean, I'm one of the two makers in the U.S., and I think I'm the only one right now doing it from scratch. So it's tough. It's tough because there's not always all the ingredients that I need available. There's not always sourcing supply available.
Does that mean you're ready to make a batch and suddenly you have to put the brakes on and stop because you can't get the right ingredients?
I got to be honest, yes. So in a lot of cases, when I do find the right ingredient, I would freeze them, make sure that I have enough. I'm buying a lot at once to make sure that I do have enough for production. So it takes a lot more planning. It takes a lot more organizing logistics, but it takes a ton of education. And that's why, I mean, being on discussing with you and having this opportunity to be in your, you know, with your audience here, I'm here to say, you know, let's support local, and especially when it's made from scratch and when we're trying to do authentic food. It's not going to be, you know, your 100-gallon kind of production. It's artisan work, and it's still very much, again, handmade, handcrafted with a ton of love. I keep adding that. So that's the biggest challenge. And having also a lot of the stores, I think I have to address this. A lot of stores are not very educated on what an African simmer sauce is. I mean, people know Indian simmer sauce. They know Italian simmer sauces. So I have to be very perseverant and, you know, just keep at it and make sure that the more consumer have information. So that's why I write a lot of recipes that I make available, you know, like free recipe. I post a lot on Facebook, social media. I've been doing a little bit of, you know, food, supporting a lot of fundraisers and not-for-profit organizations just to expose people to the food. Because once people try it, they like it. So, but it's going over the hump of trying and just, you know that it's going to be like any other, you know, simmer sauce that you've tried, but it's going to be actually more delicious, I think, and it's healthier.
Why is it important for you to do this? Why is it important for you to take the tradition that you grew up with and spread it to people here who have not grown up with it?
One of the things that I always tell my community, I don't call people my customers because that's because I'm not looking at Afrofusion as a pure commercial product. It's a point of view, my authentic point of view on a heritage that I feel it's longing to be discovered by our community. I feel that food is the most universal, you know, language. Everybody eats. And I think Africa and African food and culture are not as well known as other culture. And as I look around, as I mentioned to you when we first talked, what I really missed was a good depiction of African food that I know. That's not diluted. That's not commercialized. That's not watered down. The food that my grandmother would be proud of. When I close my eyes, when I just let myself, you know, go back 10, 15 years, what I grew up eating. And that's the food that I want everybody to experience because they would love it. And I know because it's the food from your garden, fresh food that's not tampered with any preservative, colorant, any of that stuff. Just good, simple, old food that you would love your grandmother or your mother to cook for you. And it's important for me because that's part of me. And a beautiful part of me, of my heritage that I would love for Milwaukee to discover. And we're in a global world. As people travel, we always think about, you know, sharing the goods of every, you know, society. And I feel Africa has that voice and that is awaiting to be discovered and to be shared with our community here. And I'm here to do that. And I feel I'm that voice for authentic African food.
Would your grandmother have worked with a recipe that was written down?
Oh, my grandmother. Yes. Actually, I am one thing that I'm the most proud of is when you go on my Facebook page today, my two Facebook pages, I have over 9,500 followers on my two pages. Half of that number of people is based on the African continent, nowhere else. So it speaks about the quality of the recipe that I post and the food. And what I was telling a group of foodies just about 2 days ago is what I feel so excited about is now I receive so many requests to post on the page. People from all over, Senegal, like the recipe that's posted right now on my page is coming from Gambia. People want to share with the world their culture. The culture as honest as it is that they're living. And they've been longing to find somebody who's going to be having that voice. I mean, I respect what everybody else is doing. I'm just going to focus on what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And what I'm doing, it's depict authentic African food for people who know. I call it the food of people who know. If you know African food that you would actually try in the street of Lagos, of Douala, of Accra, and anywhere else, that's the food that I cook. And I, as of now, I am not bound by, I keep saying this, by any financial constraint to dilute the product because of margin. I am pushed by principle and a vision of something that I hope people will embrace. I respect all the work that has been done by other, I guess, African food pioneer in all over the U.S., but I feel we can do better, and I'm here to do that.
Well, Yolande Deacon, we will connect people with some of these recipes, and maybe some of them will send you their recipes themselves. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yolan Deacon is the proprietor of Afrofusion Cuisine, a Milwaukee-area company that makes sauces and seasonings for African-flavored cuisine, sold online and in several local stores. You'll find several of her recipes at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. The culture of celebrity meets 19th century portraiture. We'll learn about an exhibit on at the Milwaukee Art Museum when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. If you thought that the celebrity publicity machine was a modern-day phenomenon, think again. Years before the artistic pictures of John and Yoko, centuries before People magazine photo spreads, celebrities turned to painters to put their likenesses before an adoring public. And in the 19th century, one of the leading painters of well-known Americans from the theater and celebrities from around the world was Thomas Sully. A retrospective of Sully's work is on display at the Milwaukee Art Museum. It's curated by William Rudolph and Carol Eaton Soltis, who joined us in the studio in October to talk more about the painter. Welcome to Lake Effect.
It's a pleasure.
Yes.
Is it oversimplifying things to refer to Thomas Sully as something of a celebrity artist?
Not at all, because he painted so many famous people from the 19th century, you know, presidents, queens, young Queen Victoria, before she became who everyone recognizes now when she was girlish and very pretty, and just, you know, international and national famous Americans.
He became a go-to artist for much of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. He was the leading artist in Philadelphia after the earlier generation had passed on, mm-hmm. and he was an artist whom people would seek out when they would travel to the Middle Atlantic. We have a portrait in the show of the wife of a sugar planter from New Orleans and her three oldest daughters who came to Philadelphia, and they made it a point to have Sully paint their portraits. So yes, in the world of portrait painters, he definitely was a famous one and one that you would want to make you look beautiful.
They knew they would get something different, which is part of what the thesis of our show is about, painted performance, that he gave these very lively portraits. And while they were suave and beautiful and refined, they were also full of human interest, so that, like the Rob portrait you're speaking about, you know, you'd have all these details of how the child and the children and the mother were interacting. And so you could be delighted by it as well as just look at this beautiful, elite sort of thing.
Well, and how much of his approach to subjects like that was informed by his own early history as coming from a family of performers?
We argue that it is absolutely the key. It is the thing that informs the way that Sully looks at the world and the way he puts pictures together, that he intuitively, keenly, natively understood from earliest childhood watching people who played parts for a living, that in a 21st century way, as we would say in graduate school, identity is not fixed. Sully understood this.
Right. And he allowed people to take on different roles and assume different postures and relate to the viewer. And I think that's one of the things that's very exciting about the portraits that we are showing and the fancy pieces is they sort of reach out to the viewer. It makes you think about who is this person? They're not just static. He also creates a very beautiful environment for his people to be in because they're coloristic and full of, you know, movement of light and shadow. And they're beautiful things.
There is an image, and I'm not even certain that it's part of this exhibit, but it's in the collection in this book. I was reading the book of all places on the bus yesterday, and I think it's of the McEwen sisters.
That's not in the show, but it's not dissimilar to the type of works that he created. And basically what you're referring to is there are wonderful, beautiful people in the foreground with active postures, and then there's an interesting effect in the background,
yeah.
And that comes from the theater. So in other words, it's as if Sully puts people on the apron of a stage and but is aware that upstage in the background there's bits of business going on with extras. And when you come to the show, you'll see that in a painting we have, a study for a portrait of the Marquis de Lafayette painted in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. You'll also see that in a big subject picture of Cinderella at the kitchen fire from 1843. He's very much attuned to the kind of picture that the stage makes. And as Carol was saying, that there has to be an audience to be played to.
Right, and that these things often reinforce the subject of the picture of the person being painted. And we see these in his fancy pieces as well, which are imaginative compositions, which in our thesis of the show is that these types of pictures that are really not thought about very much and there's really no scholarship on them per se are things that feed his portraiture. So his oeuvre is a lot larger than most people think. It's not just portraits. It's also these subject pictures which have a literary background to them, which again feeds into the theater. So his mind is sort of working on these different themes that have to do with, you know, life.
Well, what would you contend that he got out of this branching off into these fancy pieces? Was it a chance for him to engage his imagination in a way that perhaps some of the more standard portraiture was not?
No, that's certainly one thing. But he also – it was a financial issue because he had them on exhibit in a gallery with Sully and Earle's Gallery in Philadelphia, which was a commercial gallery that he was a partner in. These fancy pieces then sometimes were engraved, so they got into the popular literature of the day, which spread his name. And William, as you've discussed in your essay, the technical parts were critical with fancy pieces.
He uses them to experiment with different processes at times, different types of varnish layers, different ways of preparing the ground, which of course it makes sense. You really can't do that with a commissioned portrait because you might run the risk of displeasing a patron. Carol and I were fascinated to discover that Sully is a case study of what it meant to be a working artist in the 19th century. He keeps meticulous records financially of what he makes, how much he values it at, when he starts it, when he finishes it, when he's paid for it. And we learn that he isn't always paid on time.
Or he's not paid for it.
Exactly.
And how much it cost even though he wasn't paid for it.
And so the subject pictures, the fancy pictures, a lot of the time, as Carol just said, they're done on spec. He's trying to create scenes to keep his brand in front of the public and to make money either through admission to a gallery or through the rights to have it engraved,
right,
or actually also then to sell the actual work to a collector. It's a fascinating story for us to learn what it meant to, for nearly 70 years, make a living as an artist, and we know that that living was not always easy for him.
And also to be a contemporary artist. For example, the Little Nell, Asleep in the Old Curiosity Shop, which is a subject from Dickens, was painted just as Dickens is arriving in America on his tour of America. So he was like sort of the moment. You know, this is a picture people are going to want to see because everyone's reading this. The stories have just been finished, and here is the great British author. So he was always keyed into what was happening around him, you know. He was not sort of pulled back away from popular culture.
And maybe comparisons are unfair because these people are always of their time, but is there a modern-day comparison to be made to someone like a Richard Avedon or a photographer who works in that kind of celebrity?
Well, honestly, the artist who just popped into my head, and it's I can't believe I'm thinking about this. Jeff Koons. But Jeff Koons, even though his work is radically different from Thomas Sully's, is someone who from day one has always paid attention to the business of being an artist. His background actually was in business and finance before he became an artist full time. He's always followed the market. He's always paid attention to it and respected it. And Sully has similarly that same respect. Sully's not creating wonderful cast aluminum balloon animals, and Koons is not a portraitist. But he's one of the contemporary artists who has always made no secret of the fact that to be a successful artist means that one has to care about the market and has to care about money. I think Avedon is a lovely comparison as a portraitist.
Yeah. Yeah, but also talking about respecting the market, I sort of like that word because it doesn't mean you're giving into something. It means you understand where you're working, what the parameters are around you. And, you know, you don't want to turn someone into someone who's just sort of a slave to this. You know, it's not distorting his creativity.
Right. And I think I was joking around yesterday, but I do believe this. Thinking of the works that Sully painted, the subject pictures that deal with literature, whether it's a bestseller like Dickens or whether he's looking at a fairy tale, he's trying to find something. He has his finger on the pulse of pop culture. If Sully were painting today, I guarantee you he would have attempted a tasteful version of Fifty Shades of Grey. of that trilogy of whatever people are reading, right. Eat, Pray, Love, who knows? Sully would have painted a scene from it and made it as dramatic and beautiful as he knew how.
Yeah. Well, was there a certain status that went into being the subject of one of Sully's paintings? I mean, was that one of the things that the celebrities that he depicted got out of posing?
Well, I think there was a sort of glamour to his work. I mean, he particularly did that. It was based on a very glamorous British tradition of portraiture. And so people, they did seek him out to be rendered in the best possible way. But they're also very artful works. So, you know, you can hang on the wall and you can look as good as you can possibly look, but you're also you turn out as a beautiful picture. So you're getting a lot. But yeah, they are stylish. They are truly stylish.
By later in his life, photography was actually on the scene and being used for many of the same subjects that Sully painted. And in fact, there is a picture of Sully himself in book. Did photography, as it was entering the scene, shape the direction of his later work?
Sully, very late in life, made a handful of portraits that were based upon photographs. And in particular, there was a series of works, we don't have them in the exhibition, that were done for the Colonization Society out of Philadelphia that was involved with the colonization of Liberia. And the models weren't available for whatever reason, so he actually used photographic portraits to work these up. Now, they're interesting objects. We didn't include them in the show because for us, that wasn't really Sully. That was Sully using technology to make the best of a situation.
Right. Earlier, he could have used an engraving, for example, if someone wanted a certain, you know, image of someone. So it's really just another technology. And you can usually see that they're based on photographs because his style was not really conducive to reproducing a photograph. It's a looser, more, active style.
So in other words, to piggyback on what Carol is saying, often when artists – you see 19th century portraits that are based on photographs, there's a rigidity, there's a fixed expression, there's a sort of coldness and the finish is very precise, which is all about the fact that they're using this long exposure material. And Sully, as Carol said, it's flashy brushwork. It's the idea of movement and vitality and energy.
Performing brushwork,
exactly.
As you say.
And so it just was incompatible with the way that he knew how to work.
It sounds like the ideal for him would have been to be able to essentially reanimate a photograph.
Yes. What an interesting idea. Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly. I love that. That's great.
Sully painted presidents as well as theater people and others. And I wonder, that I'm sure they wouldn't have used this term in those days, but was Sully sensitive to the idea of the spin that a politician would want to get out of how he was being depicted?
Well, the Jackson portrait that we have in the exhibition, of course, is on the $20 bill. It's a wonderful image and it's, you know, his hair is sort of flying off and he looks like this very, you know, hero of New Orleans.
He's a dashing guy.
He's a dashing guy. And he did dashing extremely well.
Sully knew a lot of presidents. He painted Thomas Jefferson from life. He painted Jackson numerous times. And I think he was very aware of trying to get the character of someone out. The head of Jackson that we have in the show, it's as if everything is distilled down to the forceful personality that comes through just this bust. But he would not have been the kind of artist who would have come to a portrait of a president with the idea of this is how someone looks presidential. It's more about finding the inner quality of the individual president and bringing it out.
Like an actor. Projects.
Exactly. So irascible Jackson, who has this great personality and is fiery and has been a military hero, that sort of authority and vigor and personality is what Sully brings out rather than here is a stately sort of way. When one sees portraits often even today of bank presidents and university presidents, and it's as if it doesn't matter what the person is like because the authority, the role is what's imposed upon them. Sully is absolutely the opposite of that.
Yeah.
The celebrities that are depicted, the presidents excepted, the celebrities are generally not well known to many of us today. So what do you hope that we get from this retrospective of Thomas Sully's career
in 2013 as people take a look at his career in its entirety?
Well, I think that's interesting because, you know, it does – because he painted many famous people and many eminent people, these introduce them to the public. I also think because we're doing both portraits and these fancy pictures or these subject pictures that we're introducing that to the public too as part of the environment that Sully inhabited, what his world was like, because these were things he experienced, the literature of the day, these sort of emotions that are expressed in the literature, the fears about children that come out in his paintings, children in danger. We have a whole room of about children in danger and the way parents were feeling about, you know, children being vulnerable at that time. So there are a lot of social issues that feed in that you don't necessarily think of in terms of Thomas Sully or of a 19th century portrait painter. So I think there's a sort of, you know, ground of material here which could be interesting to people and relevant to people.
Sully's audience would have known who these actors and actresses were. They were the stars of the day. We've lost a lot of those reputations. But then again, I would like to think that 100 and some years later, someone will look at a photograph of Kim Kardashian and say, well, who was that woman who's always photographed with her chin down, sort of looking down this way? Or you know, who was this Lindsay Lohan or Miley Cyrus person? So what we do through the catalog, through the labels, through the audio tour, we try to recuperate some of these identities for people and explain who they were and why they were famous. So we hope that if you do that little bit of homework, you get a sense of biography and history.
Social history.
And are reminded that people are people then as now.
Well, thank you to both of you. Best of luck with the exhibition, and I hope it turns into a huge success.
Thank you so much.
William Rudolph is the curator of American art and decorative arts and director of exhibitions, and Carol Eaton Soltis is project associate curator of American art at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. They are the curators of the exhibition Thomas Sully Painted Performance, which is open through early January at the Milwaukee Art Museum. You'll find a link to more about it from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. The show opened in October, and we first spoke with Rudolph and Soltis then. That's all for Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. It's great to have you listening today, as it is every day at this time. We are here every weekday morning at 10 and weekend afternoons at 3. It's Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air comes your way next. Have a great day.